minister in the American Baptist Convention, has served as an assistant pastor at Second Baptist Church, an urban congregation in the heart of Evanston, outside of Chicago. He is the author of this lovely new book called The Theology of Martin Luther King Jr. and Desmond Tutu that is pretty much hot off the press. Congratulations on this. It's a lovely book. He is also co-chair of the consultation for the Theology of Martin Luther King Jr. With the American Academy of Religion. And I guess that's where we first met, on a very exciting, event-filled gathering and an interesting conversation between myself and Dr. James Cone. Some of you were there, but it was a lovely exchange with the two of us saying how much we loved each other and hugging, right, which is the way these things should end. So we are welcome to, thrilled to have you here, and I know you have some plans to mix things up a bit, but look forward to your time with us, Johnny.
Yeah, thank you very much, Charles, and I'm thrilled to be here this afternoon. I'm excited about this conversation and the opportunity to participate. I think whenever you bring together both scholars and practitioners, people who are on the front lines, and have a diverse sort of forum of conversation, that's when exciting things can certainly happen. It's such a refreshing opportunity to get the chance to know new voices and perspectives, meet new people, and develop new relationships. Desmond Tutu has this notion of this idea of delicate networks of interdependence, that sometimes through those sort of delicate conversations in passing or new relationships that are formed, you create the space for transformative actions to occur. Now, I'm from Georgia, southeast Georgia, a little place called Vidalia. And around this time of year, you know, after you eat, the temptation is to want to take a good nap. So I'm aware of that temptation, and I feel it. I mean, we're in the south, and it feels good right now just with the wind behind us. But I'm hoping what we can do is to create an atmosphere of dialogue and conversation. So I'm just going to take about 20 minutes to give an overview. Most of us are familiar with King and Tutu, so I won't sort of rehash all that I was prepared to say about these two figures, and I'm hoping that we can sort of spend some time around the tables. When I look at the bios and the personalities that are here, I get the sense there's some really exciting things going on at so many different levels. So I wonder if we can really take advantage of the relationships that are being formed and the space to have some critical dialogue at our tables. For those of you who are not at tables, what I'd like to do is after I give sort of my spiel, we can gather around the table, spend about 5 minutes or so dialoguing critically and sharing our own stories, really sort of sharing not only our work, our projects, but sharing to some extent about who we are and what we bring to our projects as we sort of unearth or sort of unpack some of these ideas about peace and forming and thinking about the language of peace for our time today. Is that okay with you? Is that process all right? All right. Okay. And then what we'll do is we'll come back and we'll have questions, we'll have dialogue and open it up a bit. If ever there was a moment when the language of peace is in desperate need of expression, it is certainly in our time. On the 40th anniversary this past April, many of us celebrated the 40th anniversary of King's assassination. And also the 10th anniversary of the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. So we still hear that the voices of King and Steel Tutu continue to offer resounding and unique perspectives on the language, and I would say the languages of peace, that we should certainly resist the notion that there is one particular meta-narrative or all-encompassing language that we can construct but to embrace the notion of the multiplicity of languages of peace as we think about what it means to live in a global world. So what I'd like to do for the next few moments, perhaps about 20 minutes or so, is to offer insights on the resounding and unique perspectives of King and Tutu and the ways in which they introduce alternative visions of peace in the shadows of empire. Alternative visions of peace in the shadows of empire. I know there's a lot of talk about empire. There's a lot of different understandings of what the concept means, what it means to us, and how people outside of the United States thinks about this notion of empire. And how I think about empire is that empire functions in many, many different ways. It goes beyond geographic and territorial boundaries. The very idea of empire reflects a certain set of beliefs, ideas, rituals, practices, symbols, and even embodies its own religious system. Both the U.S. and South Africa, with its intrinsic claims of manifest destiny, modernization, capitalistic desire, all share these imperialistic visions of the world. And I think we can talk not only about South Africa and the United States, but many of the European nations, and certainly many in the developing world as well. Considering the life and thought of King and Tutu as witnesses against empire and for peaceable community, I would argue, could yield creative insights for what it means for Christians and non-Christians alike to live faithfully and peacefully within an imperial culture of violence. Just a quick word about language. Language is essential to constructing new spaces of shared meaning, peaceful coexistence, and community. Language informs culture. Language provides the free exchange of ideas, narratives, beliefs, concepts, emotions, hopes, and fears. Language has a sort of timeless character attached to it. But language is not without its limitations. Language requires interpretation and functions within a particular social, historical, and cultural medium. The language or languages we use often reflects the particularity of our own experiences, the particularity of our own history, our own sort of interactions throughout our lives, from a moment of birth to how and to where we find ourselves on a day-to-day basis. For instance, the set of the kind of language we use is often dramatically different depending on where we grew up, depending on our own social circumstances. So to assume that there's a universality to the language we use is to somehow neglect or reject the notion that we come about understanding our language in different ways. Too often there is an assumed universality, that we assume that the language we use is true or functioning the same way for all people in different places. And to not be aware of the perspective, our point of departure, or to neglect the ways in which there are limitations to our language is to deny the ways in which it works differently in other parts of the world. As some critics of modernity have pointed out, there is indeed a gap between language and meaning. This is really nothing new. Many scholars have struggled with this reality, from Tillich to Kierkegaard and so many others. We know that there are some real challenges in looking at this gap between symbols, the symbols we use and the words and concepts we construct, and the meaning we attach to that. There's a saying that's often used in this small rural town where I'm from: small tobacco, cotton, onion, picking town of Vidalia, which says that talk is cheap. So in some ways, I'm a little suspicious of language alone, a little suspicious of the notion that we can actually construct a rhetoric, rhetorical devices that can be used to advance the idea and the reality of peace in the world. We may have very well arrived at a moment in history that Richard Lisher calls the end of words. The end of words. The Duke homiletics professor Lisher says that in a time when so much suffering has been produced as a consequence of Christian language, perhaps preachers, theologians, and Christians should just shut up. Now, I'm not agreeing. I'm a Baptist preacher, right? So we know I love to talk and preach, and so that's a real challenge for many of us. But if silence is not an option, if silence is indeed not an option, as Lisher himself admits to, then certainly one should speak about the language or languages of peace with much care and concern, with even fear and trembling. There must be intervening factors that makes the language we use, particularly around peace and justice, intelligible not only to our own unique experiences, but accessible or in dialogue with the perspectives and the experiences of others. What is compelling about the thought and witness of King and Tutu is that they offer to us a unique way of understanding the languages of peace, how it is worked out within particular historical and social circumstances, while avoiding the temptation of a universality that could be appropriated for all peoples in all places and at all times. Their visions of community, though emerging from different theological, cultural, and geographic origins, share a common assertion that ultimately the language of peace and the practice of peace are part of the same reality. King's leadership in the modern American civil rights movement and Tutu's prophetic fight against apartheid in South Africa challenged certain modern theological and philosophical presuppositions about what it means to be human. They also undermine, in my opinion, the binary linguistic systems that often lead to rigid distinctions, categorizations, particularly when it comes to living together in peace. King and Tutu's lives speak to the urgency of advancing what Yoder called the peaceable community and the convergence of theory and praxis. I think that's one of the really unique characteristics of King and Tutu's witness is the ways in which they combine theory and praxis. That they don't want to, they resist this notion of creating categories where you can somehow distance oneself from what you think and what you actually do. The violence of Jim Crow segregation and apartheid as racialized systems of social ordering were harmful on multiple levels. Violence was not only a means of sustaining and maintaining social control, but celebrated as a nationalistic idol for identity and meaning. The world of segregation and apartheid made little sense without violence. In fact, violence gave these realities meaning. Both the threat and practice of violence were religious forces of themselves that permeated the very air of Southern culture in America and life under apartheid. Whether in the form of lynching, rape, denial of resources in education, medical care, or public transportation, or white supremacist ideologies, violence was fierce and insatiable. The idea of establishing separate social systems built on violence reinforce certain modern theological and philosophical conceptions of what it means to be human. The most violent dimensions of these systems was indeed not just the physical violence, but the psychological violence that made blacks in the South and certainly under apartheid question their dignity and personhood as human beings. The denial of black subjectivity or the negation of blackness
in modernity felt throughout the African diaspora provides a perspective of how modernity looks from below. How do we critique the underside of modernity? How do we think about modernity from the perspective of the marginalized and from those who have suffered? The radical affirmation of black subjectivity and protest during the civil rights movement and resistance against the apartheid regime were embodiments of this sort of radical critique of modernity. Inasmuch as modernity had characterized human life based on a particular display of rational capacities. We all know about the famous Cartesian saying, cogito, ergo, sum, I think, therefore I am, or dubito, ergo, cogito, ergo, sum. I doubt, therefore I think, therefore I am. If being human means being a rational, morally conscious agent, as Cartesian and Kantian thought would have us to believe, then those who are excluded from the range of rational capacities acceptable for entrance into the human family, then there is ample cause to not only enslave, but to justify, even demand, demeaning treatment in order to perpetuate systems of injustice, fear, and violence. Cornel West, in my opinion, has probably offered the best treatment of race and modernity that I've seen to date. He writes about this in his book, Prophesied Deliverance, an Afro-American religious philosophy. And here he traces sort of the philosophical development of the concept of race, but also the theological underpinnings based on this kind of Aristotelian hierarchy of being that certainly received renewed attention during the modern era. West argues that the binary linguistic system of Western intellectual discourse based on the either-or way of thinking produced these distinctions and categorizations such as up and down and good and bad, right and wrong, justice, injustice, black, white, etc. All of these were witnesses to the ways in which meanings were attached to certain terms and concepts. So whiteness was equated with beauty and goodness, blackness as its negation at once. These distinctions ultimately translated into a vision of social ordering based on racial and ethnic distinctions such as those we see with Jim Crow segregation, apartheid, and colonialism. So social ordering, as I've tried to argue in my work, reflects a certain linguistic system, reflects a certain ideological and philosophical way of thinking. So before we can get to those concrete practices, and as someone who takes seriously what practices look like, we have to look at sort of the philosophical ideas that inform those practices. And what we see long before the system of Jim Crow segregation or apartheid in South Africa were constructed, these ideas, the inner workings of modernity, were thinking about how to order the world. How should human beings order their social lives together? And many of these ideas came as a result of these modern ideas about what it means to be human and what it means to live in community together. So when King mounted the pulpit of Holt Street Baptist Church claiming leadership of the Montgomery Improvement Association on December 5th, 1955, though reluctantly, he was not only leading an assault on the nearly 100-year-old system of segregation in the South along with other freedom fighters, he was also challenging the very foundations of modernity and the underside of American history and her dreams. There's always been two competing realities, two competing perspectives on what it means to be American, what it means to live in America. And Peter Hetzel is now talking about this and writing about these kind of competing realities. You know, you have this sort of one progressive reality that calls America to live up to its ideals and this other reality that sort of competes against this sort of evangelical, personalistic, pietistic kind of transformative perspective that often finds itself competing within local realities when it comes to social change. But these distinctions ultimately translated into a vision of social ordering based on racial and ethnic distinctions. King, along with other critics of modernity, and I would count King alongside other critics of modernity, including Michel Foucault, Henry David Thoreau, Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, Martin Delaney, Henry Highland Garnett, Dorothy Day, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, and many, many, many others. We're drawing, calling into question these sort of social, political, economic, as well as philosophical structures. As my good friend Charles Marsh observes in his book, The Beloved Community, How Faith Shapes Social Justice from the Civil Rights Movement to Today, in his address at Hope Street Church, King situated himself within a historical and theological transformation that would have lasting implications beyond Montgomery and even into the larger world. He writes, the beautiful chaos that America would see daily on the streets of Montgomery, the tens of thousands of African Americans walking beneath the winter sky, the empty buses rolling through the capital city, the mass meetings overflowing the black churches, bear evidence of God's presence and promise. In these passages, in that speech, that evokes a host of powerful biblical images, the disinherited of the land, the long night of captivity, the glimmering promise of deliverance, each image as alive with meaning for the sufferings and hopes of African Americans as it has been for Israel in the long years of exile. King describes the moment as the beginning of a larger and complicated theological drama. And I would go on to say that King had an early awareness that what was going on in Memphis or in Selma or in Montgomery had larger implications, not just because of the social sort of dynamics in those local spaces, but because it was challenging certain basic ideas about what it means to be human and how to order social life. So the battle's not only taking place in terms of structural, systemic, practical kinds of changes, but it's also taking place along sort of ideological lines as well. King's interpretation of Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence, Boston personalism, and the social gospel came as a result of longer, deeper cultural conversations within the African American religious tradition as early as the 18th and 19th centuries in the quest for freedom. According to religious historian Lewis Baldwin, King was fundamentally shaped within the African American religious tradition as a fourth generation Baptist preacher. So before he even showed up at Crozer Theological Seminary or attended Boston University, he was already shaped and formed within a particular kind of historical, cultural, and social context that created the lens in which he interpreted many of the ideas he received during his training. So his critique of Niebuhr, his critique of Tillich, his critique of Henry Nelson Wyman, all of them came as a consequence of how he was shaped and formed over the kitchen tables, through many sermons, growing up in his father's house and at Ebenezer Baptist Church, shaped him to think about what it means to seek sort of to advance the freedom struggle in the country. The Protestant liberalism of his studies were filtered through the lens of his African-American evangelical roots and the prophetic preaching tradition, which made it a divine mandate to speak truth to power. The Christianity of King's ancestry was a religion of resistance, of freedom, a religion that speaks of justice and liberation. He was a product of the black church tradition, and though he trained at elite, predominantly white institutions in the North, King's understanding of many of those ideas was sort of conditioned with an awareness of his own historical roots. For King, the black church provided the foundations and framework for his subsequent intellectual development. He recounted that the church has always been a place, a second home for me. As far back as I can remember, I was in church every Sunday. Lewis Baldwin's definitive account of King's cultural roots emphasizes the church's ongoing impact on King's thought and actions. As a fourth-generation Baptist minister, the idea of being deeply involved with the church was not unreasonable. And he had the unique position to have many, many different choices. He was offered a position at Garrett Biblical Institute at the time under Loder, who was the dean, rejected that offer, took the position down at Montgomery Baptist Church in order to have solidarity with the community of his roots. He was also the son of a great leader within the Atlanta community. Daddy King was very involved in the NAACP and many local efforts. His father had an already sort of national reputation of being a leader within the civil rights movement. And there's always been sort of key leaders within the African-American religious tradition who helped to raise money, who were part of certain global and local initiatives. And Daddy King, King's father, was certainly one of those for him. Through this model of leadership, King was sensitized to the sting of social Southern racism, and his unflagging responsibility to resist its unjust systems. With this heritage, it's not surprising that I also learned to abhor segregation, considering it both rationally inexplicable and morally unjustifiable. King's cultural roots, to include his familial and church environments, are reservoirs out of which his conception of community were shaped and formed. King was well acquainted with the ways in which black religion envisioned an alternative reality that brought to bear a radical critique of America, questioning its moral claims and its echoes of violence. Like the ancient Greek god of war, Mars, the violence of Southern life in the South was both unprovoked and unpredictable. Violence in the South was an illustration of the ways in which violence functions in the larger imperial paradigm. It offers a glimpse into the complexities of violence as a religion, embodying its own rituals, practices, institutions, and deities. Now, if any of you have remotely familiar with Southern life, you know there are two things you have to have. That's your Bible and your gun. I'm from Vidalia, Georgia, and you know, folks take their shotguns very, very serious. Right? You know, if you try to take somebody's shotgun, you're messing with some serious stuff. In high school, I remember kids in school would have their shotguns in the back of the trucks as they came to school, and it was no real problem. They have this practice in Louisville called Thunder over Louisville, where you have jets kind of fly around, and it's sort of a real celebration of militarism. And that's not unique. In many Southern towns across the South, you see this kind of celebration of militarism, not only around the 4th of July, but around throughout the year. So violence in the South, as I mentioned earlier, was an illustration of how violence functioned. It gives insight to. It's sort of an illustration, a case study in how violence functions within imperial practices. Max Stackhouse and Peter Paris assembled a group of scholars from around the world to reflect on the nature of Christian witness in the age of globalization and empire. And they put together a series of projects on God and globalization. In one particular project, Don Shrivers raises the compelling question of whether in the present unfolding century can humans contain their propensity for violence? Given the fact that in the 20th century, humanity witnessed the most horrendous acts of violence ever seen in the history of humankind, human life is either headed towards sustainable peace or total annihilation. And we don't have to look very far for that. We look, consider World Wars I and II, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Holocaust, genocide in Rwanda, Darfur, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Bosnia, Herzegovina. All of these different events point to the crisis that technology, that the acceleration in nuclear proliferation poses for the quest toward peace. Tears of slain innocence still cries out in distress, restlessness, and warning on what could potentially lie ahead, given the rapid acceleration in these areas. And now we have to also deal with the ecological crisis. It's very natural for me to understand the connection between sort of ecology and justice, because most of the folks where I'm from have farms. Most of them live on farms. It's still not uncommon today to have people who are not dependent at all, except for maybe electricity, on the other forces. So there's a deep connection with the land, that the land and one's sustenance is deeply connected. And this is where I think we are today. Leonardo Boff and John Sobrino and many other Latin American liberationist theologians have made this profound connection, and I think we could learn a lot by engaging those sort of perspectives and looking at this deep connection between the land and human flourishing. King, in particular, inherited an understanding of Jesus as one whose ethical life points to this radical self-sacrifice and social revolution. So looking at the life of Jesus gives insight for King on how you interpret ideas. So he considers the ethical life of Jesus as a way of sort of interpreting and processing various philosophical perspectives within the context of his dialectical methodology. The life of Jesus is a confrontation with empire because it poses an alternative vision of peace, not simply for what for that which is achieved, but its path as well. And help me out with the time, Dr. Marsh, if I'm going over. A great book by John Dominic Crossan, Crossan's analysis of this connection of Jesus and the early church and its connection with empire is a good example of this. He writes in God and Empire, Jesus Against Rome Then and Now, that Jesus and his followers and those who have sort of found solidarity with his life and thought throughout history present a way of looking at this alternative vision of peace in the shadows of empire. The noted historical Jesus scholar argues that the kind of peace promulgated by first century Roman imperialism was peace achieved through military action. It was the kind of peace that requires an ever-increasing and expanding form of dominance and violence for its maintenance and survival. In contrast to the Pax Romana, or the Peace of Rome, the peace of God in the world proclaimed throughout Palestine by Jesus was not simply problematic for the order of the outpost. It posed a serious indictment upon the theological and political establishment of the Roman Empire. Whereas the Pax Romana is constituted by the normalcy of community, of civilization's violence, Jesus made normative nonviolence as both the means and the end of community and God's reign in the world. The kingdom of which God, Jesus sought to establish contradicted the political order and the way in which power and ultimately God was conceived. Roman imperial theology was built on the notion that power was characterized by strength, dominance, control over the weak. Crossan illustrates in this quote, the first Christians therefore had to present a positive counter-mantra and a positive counter-program to Roman imperial theology's sequence of religion, war, victory, and peace. Victory, by the way, does not bring peace but only a lull, whether short or long. And after each lull, the violence required for the next victory escalates. Is there any possible alternative to first victory, then peace, or peace through victory? Yes, says Crossan. It is this: religion, nonviolence, justice, peace. Or more succinctly, first justice, then peace, or peace through justice. Crossan's observations are not unlike those raised by other pacifists such as Ralph Waldo Emerson, Dorothy Day, Albert Camus, King, Daniel Berrigan, as I think a presenter mentioned earlier, Jonathan Skull, Thomas Merton, and many, many, many others. I think some of the most prophetic and courageous peace activists are persons we will never know. There are the voices who are often not written in the history books, but very important to the quest for peace. What remains constant is the idea that the quest for peace combines theory and praxis in a way that inevitably leads to a collision course with empire. If empire requires violence for its very meaning and stability, then the practices of peace and nonviolence in the quest for justice must be challenged on both rational and moral grounds. Empire and cultures of violence know what it means to respond to violent acts of aggression. But the unequivocal march of nonviolence is both politically and spiritually debilitating. Understandings of King's appropriation of Gandhi's philosophy often dismisses the fact that Gandhi was fighting against the British Empire. As Catherine Tidrick observes in Gandhi, A Political and Spiritual Life, Gandhi employed nonviolent resistance to confront the systemic as well as the ideological forces of colonialism and imperialism in India. King translated these ideas to the American South, but still recognized that his ultimate aim was not just defeating segregation, but reordering American society toward a more peaceful, beloved community. Although King did not explicitly use the language of empire, he saw the civil rights struggle as part of the unfolding of a cosmic drama of good triumphing over evil. Local demonstrations such as the Selma March were episodes of human beings working as co-laborers with God to redeem human community, as well as social systems and a culture of violence. On March 25, 1965, King spoke on the steps of the Capitol building in Montgomery, Alabama, describing often described as the cradle of the Confederacy. Here he comforted and inspired a beaten down and wearied crowd of protesters as they marched from Selma's bloody, blood-drenched Edmund Pettus Bridge to the Capitol City. King said, "Once more, the method of nonviolent resistance was unsheathed from the scaffold, and once again, an entire community was mobilized to confront the adversary. And again, the brutality of a dying order shrieks across the land. Yet Selma, Alabama, became a shining moment in the conscience of man. There never was a moment in American history more honorable and more inspiring than the pilgrimage of clergymen and laymen of every race and faith pouring into Selma to face danger at the side of its embattled Negroes. Confrontation of good and evil compressed in the tiny community of Selma generated the massive power to turn the whole nation to a new course." And we know how important and how prophetic it was when this... All right. That's time, right, I guess. All right. But he goes on to say that like an idea whose time has come, not even the marching armies can halt us. We are moving into the land of freedom. Let us therefore continue our triumph and march to the realization of the American dream. Our aim, he says, must never be to defeat or humiliate the white man, but to win his freedom, his friendship, and understanding. We must come to see that the end we seek is a society at peace with itself, a society that can live with its conscience. King's life and witness produced a global ethic of nonviolence, community, and justice, which characterizes peace not just as the absence of conflict, but the presence of justice. He inspired a whirlwind of global consciousness across the world, particularly in South Africa, among many youth activists like Stephen Biko, Nelson Mandela, Alan Bozak, and certainly the latter young Desmond Tutu. Tutu once remarked that the only solution to South Africa's crisis is for whites to accept blacks as human beings. Now, he didn't use the language of modernity and the presuppositions of modern discourse, but he was saying something very compelling about what it means to enter into the language of peace. You have to first affirm the dignity of the human person and of the other before you can even sort of engage the question of peace, because peace presupposes a sort of interaction among equals. And this is what Tutu was attempting to say, that before we can kind of move toward this progressive effort of transforming South Africa, there has to be sort of a remote affirmation of the dignity and personhood of the other. These words display the degree to which Tutu was battling not only the structural demons of apartheid, but the ideological forces of modernity with its rejection of black subjectivity. South Africa under apartheid was an extension and companion of the American imperialistic vision of the world. There are striking similarities between the ideas of manifest destiny informing earlier colonial activities in both the U.S. and South Africa. It's really interesting when you look at the history of South Africa and the history of the United States, there are profound similarities. These similarities also translate into the lives of King and Tutu. Although they were born in different geographic areas, different theological and cultural traditions, they arrive at some of the basic ideas about community, peace, and nonviolence. Tutu is a natural conversation partner to King because both figures share so much in common in terms of their prophetic roles in opposing racialized systems of segregation and violence. Both King and Tutu received Nobel Peace Prizes. Both were once cast as public enemy number one in their own context by their governments. As an Anglican priest, Tutu took seriously the Eucharistic concept of consubstantiation, where Christ is present in communion. It's a very important idea to Tutu's thought. He engaged his liturgical theology from the cathedral to the streets of Johannesburg, Cape Town, Pretoria, and Swaziland. It was precisely because of his affirmation of the presence of God in not only the Eucharistic celebration, but in all Christian practices, including prayer, acts of forgiveness, healing the sick, almsgiving, confession, and repentance, that provided for him the resources to confront apartheid and to give him the resources to serve as leader of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Tutu radicalized liturgical practices. Drawing on his liturgical and cultural origins, Tutu was sensitive to the ways in which language and practice around issues of reconciliation, peace, and healing are commingled and require a delicate balance of speaking, hearing, and acting. After just assuming the post as Dean of St. Mary's Cathedral in Johannesburg in 1975, the first black to hold such a position, Tutu wrote an open letter to the Prime Minister where he writes, and this is very interesting, Tutu's process. He never stopped holding fast to the dignity of the other, even the oppressor. A lot of times we think about sort of affirming the dignity of the oppressed other. But what Tutu did, which is what I think is very interesting, is he wanted to affirm the dignity of the oppressor. He wanted to affirm the notion that there's something within every human being, particularly every Christian, that wants to do the right thing. And so he writes this letter when he first sort of gets into his new office, saying, "I'm writing to you as one human to another human person, gloriously created in the image of the selfsame God, redeemed by the selfsame Son of God, who for all our sakes died on the cross and rose triumphant from the dead and reigns in glory now at the right hand of the Father, sanctified by the selfsame Holy Spirit, who works inwardly in all of us to change our hearts of stone into hearts of flesh. I am writing to you, sir, as one Christian to another, for though our common baptism, for through our common baptism, we have been made members of and are united in the body of our dear Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. This Jesus Christ," he says, Whatever we may have done has broken down all that separates us irrelevantly, such as race, culture, sex, status, etc. In this Jesus Christ, we are forever bound together as one redeemed humanity, black and white together. Reflecting on the TRC and Tutu's role, John DiGrucci observes that reconciliation, thinking about the work of Tutu, is something that occurs through the interplay of speech, listening, and action, motivated by hope and love. The way in which we speak with and listen to the alienated other is already an action that makes reconciliation a possibility. Both words and deeds are necessary if we are to rescue reconciliation from the banality and recover its costly connection with telling the truth and social justice. DiGrucci asserts that the most effective way of expressing the meaning of reconciliation in the Christian narrative is through storytelling, instead of through expositions of Christian dogma. Speaking through storytelling, instead of these sort of expositions or sort of systematic constructions of theology, was reflected, according to DiGrucci, in the early church. Speaking of the early apostolic church, DiGrucci affirms that centuries before systematic theologies of atonement, redemption, or comprehensive doctrines of reconciliation were developed, the idea of reconciliation was simply narrated, proclaimed, and celebrated as the story of God's salvation. He offers examples of the Jewish narration of the Passover and the Exodus, as well as the celebration of the Eucharist, as a retelling of what happened the night Jesus was arrested, and as a way of demonstrating both the power and effectiveness of storytelling in expressing the Christian faith. And we know that many indigenous cultures and many cultures throughout the world have embraced this notion of storytelling for centuries, a lot longer than certainly the Christian faith has been around. It's a very powerful way of communicating and sharing the gospel. He goes on to say that many of the stories recounted in stories of violence, hurt, suffering, and redemption throughout the weeks of the Truth and Reconciliation hearings spoke both to the depth of human suffering and the transformative character of forgiveness. The language of forgiveness, for example, as an individual and communal act, paved the way for inhabiting new realities of peace and justice. What Tutu's experience with the TRC also revealed was the delicate nature of peace when the wounds of the past refuse to go away. As Miroslav Wolf intimates in his book, The End of Memory, what does it mean to remember rightly? What does it mean to remember in a way that reflects restorative, constructive justice, healing, and peace? Tutu struggled with such questions as the chair of the TRC and throughout his pilgrimage in the battle against apartheid. And I'll just say a little bit very quickly about sort of the essence of, I think, Tutu's theology, which is this concept of Ubuntu, Ubuntu theology. Some of you might be familiar with that concept, but it basically says that human beings become fully human through others, that we become human through others, through the sharing of stories, through authentic interactions, human beings become more fully human. It reflects a sort of African communal spirituality, which Denise Ackerman calls sort of this creative interaction of personalities and communities. Through the sharing of stories, one gains a better understanding of self and subsequently and more profoundly an understanding of the other. And I guess I'll just kind of pause right there.